Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami.
It always comes to mind, really, that we've got such a precious opportunity here in this monastery for those of us who can partake of it, especially in these quieter times. It's not always quiet. We go through our busy periods with different people coming and going, different things going on. But somehow in between that we manage to have these quieter times and to be able to focus more on the meditation practice for each of us individually. It's very precious, supported by those times, supported by what I mean those times, by more quietude, more solitude, more silence, and more spaciousness to be able to contemplate, to be able to keep one's focus directed to this body and mind. Certainly in this tradition, the meditative path, the contemplative path for practitioners in this tradition of the forest tradition is very much focused on observing this body-mind. This is where we find the Dhamma that the Buddha's pointing to, the Dharma of both the conditioned and the unconditioned reality. We find the experience of suffering through this very body-mind, but he's also pointing to the possibility for a full realization of the unconditioned, that which is no longer suffering, that which is beyond suffering, that which cannot suffer. With the realization of this unconditioned reality, a person can no longer suffer in the same way as they have done before. So this truth of suffering and the end of suffering is here to be discovered, to be understood in our very own experience of this body-mind, or what we might traditionally refer to as the experience of the khandhas in their various manifestations, the aggregates of existence, of material form, feeling, perception, mental formations of all kinds, and sense consciousness, right here. And in my retreat, or whenever I have opportunities to practice, I often take inspiration from the forest masters, the forest teachers who've more recently, in the last, I say recently, and I'm talking about the last century, but even in the last few decades, those teachers who have followed up this practice and realized the truth for themselves completely, and the way they've taught within this tradition is very straightforward, is very direct, and a few, what shall we say, the pithy teachings that come out of that again and again show the direct path. So within the Buddhist teachings, in the scriptures, in the suttas, we also have some very pithy teachings, but a much wider, a very wide variety of analysis. Even purportedly from the Buddha's own lips, of the various ways the mind is caught up in suffering and the various obstructions and distortions of perceptions that we experience, which kind of obstructs our vision of the truth and which causes suffering. So we have many different ways portrayed in the suttas let's say, developing this path of practice. Mindfulness, of course, holds center stage in so much of the practice, whether when we look in the suttas or whether hearing from those teachers who are still living, some who are still living, but some who have passed in the last century, particularly in this forest tradition, mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, holds center stage in developing this path of realization. So mindfulness is something we have to really come to understand, to know what that is in our own minds, in our own experience, and in its wide, in the whole, let's say, depth and breadth of what it's pointing to, or what it is, of what that experience is. And it can take a long time to come to know this and to learn how to apply mindfulness and to develop mindfulness. When we look at the main sutta on the foundations of mindfulness, the Buddha's pointing towards this very body as the first foundation of mindfulness, and the necessity to develop mindfulness established in the body or on the body or in regard to bodily experiences. And I'm sure you all know that sutta in particular. But talking about the body in various modes, it's not just one mode, but there is the body in terms of the four elements, looking at the body in terms of sensation and beginning to discern the earth element, what's called or referred to as the earth element, or solidity or resistance or hardness, that perception of body that we're so familiar with and yet we don't really pay much attention to it, the sense of solidity, of weight, of hardness, of resistance, the water element, which is sometimes called cohesion, I believe, as it's experienced with all the different fluids within the body, and we can even, you know, the simple things like saliva or perspiration or fluid in the eyes, or sensing the blood rushing through the veins, or even if we cut ourselves, seeing the blood. This kind of water element, just contemplating that, but also the sense of cohesion. The fire element is more obvious in terms of the thermal quality of heat and cold, warmth, coolness. We experience fairly continually in relation to the body. and the earth, water, fire, air element, or the wind element, digestion is so much, you know, the winds that in the sutta talks about, the upward moving winds and the downward moving winds, you know, very obvious mundane things like burps and farts. You know, this is also becoming aware of the body as a function. You know, it's nothing esoteric, but we've never really paid much attention to it. And then how we perceive those elemental experiences, and then how we conceive of it as a me and a mine, as a what I am, in terms of this material form, this body. And our conceiving of it, our believing in it as a self, as a me, you know, our sense of egoic self, our sense of belief in some kind of permanent entity that I am, somehow takes up residence in this experience of material form. So this is just one aspect of mindfulness of the body, but part of the learning, I'll take this up, the four elements, part of bringing mindfulness to that is not only discerning, bringing awareness, applying attention, directing attention, bringing awareness to that, sustaining interest in that, exploring that with the investigative mind, but also noticing not only what these experiences and perceptions are in your moment-by-moment experience, their different characteristics, but noticing their changingness, noticing the quality of changeableness. In fact, when we start to become mindful of experiences in the present moment, part of that mindfulness practice is starting to notice this quality of anicca, or changeability. And it's everywhere, it's absolutely everywhere throughout all of our experience, whether we call it internal experience or external experience. This quality of change of any condition that we might experience. And beginning to notice this changingness, this quality of anicca, is so much a part of this mindfulness practice. And we really need to not only know and directly experience this body-mind as it's occurring, as it's arising, as it's manifesting, but also knowing it as it is and noticing its changeability, its fluctuation. And noticing how when we're doing that, where we experience suffering in the process is usually when we get stuck on some experience, where the mind sticks to something and thinks of it in one way or another in terms of I, me and mine. You'll notice that's where suffering starts to arise, whether it's, you know, something that we like or something we don't like, something we want to keep, something we want to get rid of, something we consider as good or bad. So we overlay once we have this sense of self or I am-ness, then there's this overlay about what I want and what I don't want. And this is the sticky play of desire, of craving, of tanha upadana coming in. And this is to be observed as well. This is to be known, to be understood, just as it is. These are also conditioned arisings or conditioned experiences that are there to be seen and known, understood. So this is within the domain of mindfulness, developing mindfulness, learning to apply attention to present moment experience, and learning to sustain your attention. So we're starting to create this mindfulness through application. There's some effort there, obviously. There needs to be enough interest, there needs to be enough energy, there needs to be enough confidence and faith to begin to explore and to sustain your exploration. There needs to be enough what we might call samadhi, but let's just say stillness, or enough calmness. It doesn't have to be this much or that much, but just enough to sustain an exploration. So these are all spiritual factors, the investigation being, or exploration being, part of the wisdom factor. So this we do in terms of the body, our experience of body in terms of elements, our experience of the body in terms of just moving around. You know, another aspect of mindfulness of the body is just how the body moves, gets up from a sitting posture, starts walking, standing here, laying down here, just being aware, bringing mindfulness to bear upon this experience of moving in a bodily form, and just noticing how that is, you know. And in formal, say, walking meditation, we might be a bit more particular in terms of choosing a particular aspect of walking to keep applying attention to, like the sensation of the touch of each foot as you walk. Or it could be just the sensation of the arms moving or the legs moving, or just knowing simply the body's walking forward, the body's stopping, turning, walking forward, that kind of thing. So these are different ways we can apply mindfulness to the movement of the body, the different functions of the body. The Buddha's encouraging just, you know, throughout the whole day, your different experiences, bringing mindfulness to bear just on this moment and what the body is doing. To know that, to notice that, to be clear about that with your knowing. So you're establishing awareness of that in whatever you're choosing to focus on or just acknowledge. And then sustaining or following up, sustaining that attention. And part of mindfulness is also knowing appropriateness of the application of attention to the context. So if it's morning time and you're cooking or you're using a mattock, you know, your mindfulness is also taking into account what you need to do to accomplish the job at hand and how you need to apply attention. But nevertheless, it doesn't mean you can't be mindful. I must say it gets harder on computers. Being mindful of your work on computers is really hard, especially with emails, I find. I would have really liked the Buddha to be able to comment on computers and virtual reality and emails and various other things when computers explode and all that. But you know, because now you've got a virtual community you're relating to, you know, and a lot of different aspects that are going on in the course of answering an email. But nevertheless, it's all possible to be mindful of. Sometimes we have to slow it down, but even so, sometimes we have to move fast for whatever reason. It doesn't mean we can't be mindful, but mindfulness and wisdom chooses the way to be mindful that is appropriate for the time and place and what's going on. Mindfulness of breath, watching the in and out breathing, is also an aspect of mindfulness of body, the exercises there. I'll come back to that just to mention that the other contemplations in the first foundation of mindfulness is to contemplate the 32 parts of the body very simply, you know, actual physical things, just bringing your mind to recognize hair, skin. What's that experience of skin, the feeling of skin, fleshiness of blood, internal, external, just to bring knowing to a present moment experience, turning attention a particular way, knowing something in the present as it is, just for what it is. This is the application of mindfulness. And if there's enough interest to sustain one's attention there. So these all become objects of mindfulness. To complete what's in that first foundation, there's also the exercise of contemplating one's own death, or the liability to decay and death of this body, through what's traditionally called the corpse meditations, which are traditionally kind of visualizations of different stages of a decaying corpse, and comparing that with the one's own body, knowing that my body, this body too, is of the nature to decay and die and pass away. And part of that contemplation is taking it all the way to the bones being so old that they're turning into dust, and recognizing these bones too are of that same nature, you know. And so it's the elements returned to the elements in the end when this body dies. The body is just made up of elements. It returns to the elements. Yeah. So this is all part of establishing mindfulness of body. You don't have to do all of the exercises, but all of them are opportunities to really and focus on different aspects of bodily experience, which can usurp one's delusion around relating to this body as something pleasant. Ultimately, because it's, you know, if you start looking into the 32 parts and everything, it doesn't, you lose that perception of pleasantness, of being attractive, of somehow being a source of pleasure, and also just undermining that illusion that this is me and mine, this is who and what I am. So when you're really start to take things apart, or when mindfulness begins to examine, quite naturally the mind's perceptions reconfigure. So it's not as if you're trying to overlay one perception with another, but mindfulness helps the mind reconfigure its view and its understanding. So this is how insight arises naturally, through the application of mindfulness, attention to present moment experience, and seeing certain aspects of that in reality, just the way it is. So the changeableness, this quality of anicca, is particularly important to uprooting the distortion of perception of permanence. So if mindfulness does its job, mindfulness and wisdom does its job, that perception changes automatically. It's not like you have to believe in a perception of impermanence, or try to talk yourself out of the idea that, of this feeling that of permanence, but rather mindfulness and wisdom changes the view. So this is the importance of establishing mindfulness and beginning to establish an inquiry, because it does its own work. And as the Buddha points to these path factors that we develop in terms of the Eightfold Path and in terms of the meditative components, this does its own work. If we apply the causes, the results come in a certain way, and the results are a correcting of distorted view and bringing out insight, leading to a full insight or full awakening into reality, into knowing the truth of the conditions, of the conditioned world, of the conditioned reality, and also the unconditioned, that which is not bound up within these conditions, that is also there to be seen and understood. So this opportunity to establish mindfulness, you know, when we first start practicing, it's a bit like the image that just arose in my mind, which never has done before. It's like playing darts for the first time, you know, in a dartboard on a wall, a handful of darts. If you've never done it before, you know, you're just throwing these darts and it's not quite, you know, some of them are hitting the wall, not getting the dartboard. But still, you know, you've been told just throw a dart like this and you aim for the bullseye. But doesn't necessarily always hit its mark. You know, there might be a coincidence or a fluke. But after a while, after we get the hang of it, you know, we start to, through mindfulness really, we start to get used to the weight of a dart and what the distance means and the kind of effort and application in the energy that comes from our arm. We start to adjust our eye to the aim, adjust our mind to being focused, and we start seeing when we go wrong, you know, the more we apply mindfulness, we see how a dart can go flying off that way. So it's the same way when we begin to learn to apply mindfulness. It can be a bit hit and miss. We can feel like we're working in the dark a lot of the time. All we know is that to be mindful of this present moment, we pick up some meditation object like the breath or the body, and we do our best with it, right? And sometimes with beginner's mind, really good insight can come out of this as perceptions begin to shift all by themselves. But sometimes it can be frustrating, because sometimes you feel like you don't know what you're doing and you're just kind of hammering away. But the more you are willing to engage with this practice and to just really try to keep things simple, because our mind, our conditioned mind, complicates everything, let's face it. Our sense of self and what we want, what we're looking for, the conditioned qualities of desire and aversion, they're all complicating everything. This is the experience of suffering, let's face it, right? But the more we're willing to see, the more we're willing to just apply Just bring attention back to this present moment and to choose something in this present moment that the Buddha recommended, the foundations of mindfulness, an aspect of this body, an aspect of feeling, feeling tone, whether an experience is pleasant, painful, or somewhere in the middle, kind of neutral. Or establishing mindfulness on the states of mind or the moods of mind, knowing is this mind affected by things like desire or aversion or confusion? Is it affected by doubt, by sleepiness, by restlessness? To know exactly, to bring mindfulness to bear on those things. Is the mind peaceful? Is it unagitated or is it agitated? And there's a set of examples that the Buddha gives in the Satipatthana Sutta about what to be mindful of, but it pretty much is summed up in what I've mentioned. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is mindfulness of Dhamma, which in the Pali version of the Satipatthana Sutta has I think five different categories of Dhamma, things to be aware of, things to come to know, to things to come to thoroughly know and understand and be aware of. And that's, we talk about the five hindrances, the five khandhas, the six sense bases, the seven factors of enlightenment, and the four noble truths. So these, in other recensions, and you don't always get those five groups, but all five are there in the Pali. And all of them, I believe, are really, really relevant for our practice path, for awakening. It's quite interesting the sequence that they're displayed in, like the five hindrances. They're really things that we do need to come to know and understand because they prevent the mind from actually settling. And it's wisdom that comes to know, you know, mindfulness and wisdom that comes to know what are these hindrances that are affecting the mind. Quite typically, desire, aversion, doubt, restlessness and worry, or sloth and torpor. So we need to come to know these things. The five khandhas I mentioned earlier is the constituents of existence, this body mind itself in physicality, mentality, materiality, if you like, form, physical form, material form, feeling, perception, mental formations, sense consciousness. So this is our field of investigation. The world we experience, all of our experience falls into any of these categories. You know, five fingers on one hand. This is mnemonically really helpful because to think of all of our experience, all the people we relate to, all the different relationships we have, all the things going on in the world and the cosmos out there and the diseases in here and all the problems, it's just too much to get a handle on. But you can easily get a handle on five khandhas in this moment, seeing is this, you know, a physical sensation? Is it a feeling tone? Is it a perception? Is it a thought or mental formation? Is it sense consciousness? Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, knowing? You know, it all kind of is so helpful for seeing reality moment by moment and knowing it according to Dhamma. Knowing it according to Dhamma. You'll see these five categories that the Buddha used, and I believe they were in existence. They were known to contemplatives before the Buddha started teaching them as well. The six sense bases, they're included in the, you know, pointing to this experience of sense consciousness at the six senses arising based on the eye and visual objects, experiences based on the ear and audible objects, etc. Experiences based on the mind as the sixth sense, and objects of the mind. You know, and all the sense experience become an object of the mind through perception. So, and in fact, you know, once again we have these six categories where we can actually be aware of the whole gamut of our experience through just knowing what's arising at any of the sense doors at any particular time. So this is so helpful for what we call the establishing of mindfulness and the development of awareness of at these sense doors, to know what's happening and to see the changeableness of those experiences. So to know it is just to directly be aware of it and experience, as most of these things are, they're transients. They kind of arise and cease momentarily. Moments of contact, sense contact. Momentary thoughts, momentary perceptions, momentary feelings. Momentary sensations. Yet somehow all of this experience, which is quite momentary, transient, very changeable from one moment to the next, somehow the mind has been conditioned to turn, whip up all of this and turn it into a solid sense of me and mine and what I am. A kind of an ownership, a sense of identification with it, to the point that we suffer because of it. We often find ourselves struggling with it in a push-pull relationship. So establishing mindfulness is so important to get to know what is the true nature of this experience. Even though obviously our motivation is to find freedom from suffering, as is promised by the Buddha in cultivating this path. But first we really have to understand what is this experience as it is? So the clarifying, bringing mindfulness, awareness, and interest, investigation into this moment-by-moment experience. A willingness just to be mindful of it. As it appears, as it persists, as it dissolves, disintegrates, changes. And when we're talking about these particular categories in the foundation of mindfulness of Dhamma, this then leads into the seven factors of enlightenment. And the seven factors of enlightenment actually appear, arise as conditioned arisings based upon your application of mindfulness, and particularly in relation to these things just mentioned, the hindrances, the khandhas, the sense bases, or the sixth sense experience. Through the application of mindfulness, which is the first enlightenment factor, it starts to develop strength, starts to develop momentum, starts to energize through its continual application. And I've talked about this before in terms of just the simple, obvious example of developing a muscle through, you know, lifting a weight, you know, and that repetition of lifting a weight, how that, for anyone can do that, develop one particular muscle by just lifting this dumbbell, you know, and the muscle develops because that is part of its nature. If it gets worked like this, it develops, yeah? Well, similarly, the Buddha's telling us with mindfulness, and with these other factors of awakening, once we start to work it, it starts to develop, it starts to grow its own strength, yeah? And then it starts to do the work all by itself. You know, whereas previously, like when you're lifting a 5 kilo dumbbell, initially when you've got no muscle, you've got to put in effort, don't you? And it starts to hurt, you get tired, you feel the muscles ripping, you know. But once the muscle starts to develop strength, you know, 2 weeks' time, 3 weeks' time, lifting a 5 kilo dumbbell doesn't seem like much, yeah? So you don't have to put in as much effort, yeah? The muscle's doing the work. So that's a little bit like mindfulness. Starts to gather its own strength, and similarly the wisdom factor, which is the second awakening factor, enlightenment factor, is investigation into states. Investigation, that's the wisdom factor. You're starting to look into this moment by moment experience. You're interested in it. You're interested in observing it. Observing it, just watching it like we would watch. If you want to know what a gangang is, you hear that funny squawking. It's not a cockatoo, it's not a budgerigar, it's not a kookaburra. You go, what is it? And you start looking around and you've seen a picture of a gangang. You know, it's got this crazy punk red hairdo on a grey feathered body, but you haven't seen it before. So you're curious, you start looking, where is it? You're looking into the trees, so you're observing, you're following the sound, you're observing until you see it. This is the investigation of states. So once we have mindfulness holding a particular object in mind and you're interested in it, you start looking, you want to know what this is. So it's the inquiry, the awareness, the knowing factor of the mind that is looking into, is noticing these qualities of changeableness, what the qualities of this particular state is that you might be exploring, whether it's the elements in the body or whether it's the hindrances, whether it's a painful, frustrated, desirous state you're experiencing, or an angry mind state, or a painful feeling, whatever it is, be interested in it. The application of mindfulness, knowing it for what it is, inquiring into it. So you're holding it in mind and you're following it up with the inquiry. These are starting to work together, mindfulness and wisdom. Sati sampajanya, sati panya. Mindfulness, clear comprehension or full awareness, it's growing stronger together with wisdom, panya, starting to see more clearly the nature of what it is you're observing. That could be any aspect of this body-mind experience, but it has to be in the present moment for you to observe it. Like there has to be a gangang in that tree for you to catch sight of it. Yeah? And this can get a bit tricky, because just like you can go to a book and see what a gangang looks like rather than seeing one in the flesh, so the mind can return to its intellectual understanding of Dhamma, you know, and start to think about things. And sometimes that's helpful for directing your mind back to what it is you want to investigate or to maintain the contemplation. But sometimes you get caught up in just thinking about it, thinking what I should be doing and what I shouldn't be doing. And as we know, thinking is such a habit, we can spend a lot of time there. Thinking can be helpful in some ways in Dhamma. It can direct attention. It can help re-establish our attention on the object through recollecting the teaching, recollecting. So it's helpful. But just beware if it gets too much, that you're just starting to think about it rather than just observing what's actually happening. But when you start to wake up, when mindfulness is re-established, you can recognize, that thinking pattern. It's just caught up in a concept, in a conceptual construct, and how different that is from the reality now of just really feeling the breath coming in and going out, really observing the quality of sensations as they're changing in front of your mind's eye. You know, it's a different, qualitatively different. So, but this is good for us to know, to get clear on how the mind gets pulled into thought constructions, and then when we wake up out of that. You know, so this is a fairly perpetual inquiry. But anyway, these enlightenment factors, it starts building upon mindfulness, application of mindfulness as that grows in strength, together with the inquiry, investigation of states, these two work together. They become really powerful mechanisms in the mind, and they give rise to more energy, more interest. When that energy's there, it's driving it a bit more, driving the inquiry. And then that energy, in terms of this flow of enlightenment factors, gives rise to pitti, or what gets called as joy, or sometimes it just gets called as rapture. It can be minor, it can be major, but it kind of is a very pleasant state arising out of this increased energy and clarity. And the mind is becoming more unified. You know, this is, pitti is a jhana factor, the first couple of jhanas, the first and second jhana. And from pitti, the next enlightenment factor, that gives rise to pasati, a tranquility. Because the Buddha talks about when the body and mind experiences pitti, it becomes very relaxed. So it moves into tranquility, which is also an aspect of the mind being unified in samadhi, because the activity of the mind is being tranquilized. But there's still this bright energy, strong, clear mindfulness and investigation of states going on. So these enlightenment factors building on mindfulness. You've got mindfulness, dhamma vichaya, investigation of states, the energy, the pitti, pasati, and samadhi, where the mind really comes into a unification, where the activity, the sense of the mental activity is really stilling out, but there's still this brightness of observing, of knowing exactly what's going on. There's still observing some aspects of this body-mind experience, but in terms of the confusion or diffusion or agitation of the mind, it really stills out with samadhi. And then upekkha is equanimity, enlightenment factor. So these seven are called enlightenment factors because they usher in, they build on each other, and they usher in awakening. Or one could say they're the springboard for insight, bringing the mind to a place of stillness with this, suffused with this strong mindfulness, investigation and energy, looking into the nature of things, looking into the nature of present moment experience. So wherever you may find yourself in your practice, whether you're investigating body, feelings, perceptions, mind states, or looking at these patterns of Dharma in and of themselves, they're also faculties of mind, states of mind that make appearances, and we're encouraged to know them as they are, to also see them as changeable. They're not permanent. They're also conditioned states, but they're extremely skillful. They're conditioned states of the path that issues in insight and awakening. Yeah, but they're not, they're also conditioned states, important to recognize. They're not who and what you are, but they usher in this insight into reality, which frees the mind ultimately from greed, hatred, delusion, from the asavas, from the taints. So in this fourth foundation of mindfulness, after we get the seven factors of enlightenment, we have the Four Noble Truths, which is really representative of the insight into reality, insight that the liberating insights is understanding these Four Noble Truths. The truth of dukkha, of suffering, its origin, how it comes to be, its cause, how it comes to cease, how it's abandoned, how it's stopped, how it doesn't come, and the path that brings the mind to that point of the stopping of dukkha or the abandoning of dukkha. So it was really the abandoning of craving, which is the cause of dukkha. So this coming at that as that fifth category, really representing that insight, which brings in the full awakening, or even any stages along that path. So this is such a rich teaching, the four foundations of mindfulness, and it's really our mainstay in the practice. And the Buddha actually introduces this teaching as different translations will say different things, but as the path of practice that goes in one direction only, that is to awakening, that is to the full awakening. So really this is a lifetime cultivation. And any other cultivations within the Buddha's practice path will always partake of mindfulness. And you know, one's journey might not partake of every exercise found within that Satipatthana Sutta, but it will certainly partake of the pith of all four foundations. So this is a, you know, the wonderful opportunity we have in any practice setting, as I was mentioning earlier, and also the mainstay of the forest monastics in this tradition is the working to establish mindfulness, and a key word is unremittingly. When mindfulness becomes an enlightenment factor, it's always an enlightenment factor, but where it starts to build momentum, and I think it may be in the sutta or the Anapanasati Sutta, talking about the cultivation of unremitting mindfulness, unremitting application, and it starts to build momentum. So this is the opportunity when we have some retreat time or extended periods of solitude, we can apply our mind in a way that's, you know, we develop this ability. It's a gradual development to just keep applying, to keep being present, keep letting go of whatever seems to distract one. And I say seems to because that very distraction can become an object of mindfulness. So it doesn't actually have to be a distraction, you know. So everything can be included. And in fact, watching one's mind, whether one's sitting, walking, standing, lying down, making a cup of tea, doing work, you know, everything is included. Observing everything, understanding the nature, the cause and effect of what's unfolding. And it's there to be seen. You know, I have a mind that tends to think too much about things, you know, analyzing. Over-analyzing quite often, so I have to catch myself, you know, don't try to know more than what is actually here, you know, because to observe just what is actually here can bring you more direct insight than trying to work it out with your thinking mind, you know, and once that direct insight comes through, the mind is clear. So it's an unfortunate habit of the mind, and our education will tend to reinforce it as we, you know, and thinking things through is important sometimes, but when you start trying to think through the Dharma to the full end, it's like, no, we're not on the path here, we're just thinking about it. The path is always about just being present, because that's where things show themselves to be exactly what they are, which are momentary manifestations of conditions. You know, where the past can just drop away, it's gone. You know, the future has not yet appeared. There is just this. And to know that much is enough for mindfulness and investigation. To know that much can be enough to wake up as well. But quite naturally, we've all got habits and karma and conditioning, so it is a gradual process for us to come to a place where we're developing that steadiness or cultivating that unremitting mindfulness in all of our activities. So I just wanted to re-emphasize too that when we're establishing mindfulness, you know, it'd be really, even though we've got this, we have this idea of a goal, and you know, be careful about the kind of energy you're putting in. Because when we talk about unremitting mindfulness, you know, maybe it's a bit like going back to that older analogy I used, you know. If your muscle hasn't yet been developed and you're trying to lift up a 20 kilo weight with one arm, you know, it's not going to work. You're going to do yourself some damage and you're going to be disappointed and upset or, you know, whatever. So just remember, it takes time to develop some momentum and to be careful about the desire to overreach. Again and again, you know, that desire comes up to overreach. So keep remembering, it's just about this, it's just about now, it's just about whatever's here. Just to know that. To know that as it is. That's all we need to do. And to have confidence in that, develop confidence in that as a path. Develop confidence in your ability to keep coming back to that inquiry. To develop interest in it, that might be one of the key things, to develop interest, because if you try and force the mind to do something, you know, it has a rebellious streak, it won't do it. It wants something, it wants, you know, a tasty bit there, what's in it for me? So if you have this interest, like I actually really want to know this experience, it holds your mindfulness there, it holds your attention, and the inquiry builds upon that, and then you start to gather momentum. And what's difficult is when we come up against the painful states, the habitual ways of thinking about myself in negative sense. These can be hard to bear with, and we often, the mind believes in them and spins off on them, and then we lose some kind of momentum until we wake up again and say, hang on, that's just a perception. That's just a notion in the mind, or that's just a sensation. Can I maintain my interest to see beyond this negative self-view or a painful feeling? Sustain it enough to see it change. That's when you have to have confidence in this quality, this characteristic of anicca. But things do change. Even when you feel like you've come up against something that's not changing, you know, that's definitely a delusion. You know, we've created a solid sense of self out of it in our mind. So see if you can just remember this quality of anicca and start to observe the changingness even as you're with it. The way Ajahn Chah really emphasized this teaching was very productive, has been very productive for many people. And the Buddha's emphasis on seeing again all throughout the suttas, even all from the most mundane states to the most sublime, refined states of deep jhana, the Buddha's emphasis is to see anicca, see its changeability. It's not a permanent state. Even if it's a highly skillful state and can support the path, we also have to see its changingness to really wake up, to really wake up to the unconditioned reality, to let go of that clinging, grasping, identifying mind. We have to see this changeability. So Ajahn Chah, for himself, he developed this practice where he would say to himself, when he's observing something, this is not a sure thing. This is not a sure thing. And some people have taken up that practice and used it in their own. So what it does, it's like when the mind believes something to be real or permanent, like when you really believe in that sense of depression or sorrow or even enlightenment. I've got it now, you know. I've really got it now. Or I'm this way, or she's this way, or he's that way. You know, to challenge any kind of idea that looks like the mind is believing and say, is that true? Is it a sure thing? Is that really how it is? Notice that the mind views and ideas present themselves as true. It's like this, she's like this, he's like this, it should be like this, you know, but not a sure thing. It's just a perception, it's just an idea, it's just a thought, it's just a feeling in this moment. So you're bringing it back to Dhamma. And as soon as you do that, the thing will change. It doesn't sustain. So that's this challenging, but in a gentle way. And Ajahn Liam too, in his talks that I've read recently, very much practicing strongly with this perception of anicca, which brought him tremendous fruit in this practice, in a very fast, you know, relatively quick time. Really just not believing in states, but being willing to keep observing and knowing whatever I'm experiencing now, it's anicca, it's going to change. Or just observing that change, but when you come up against believing that something's solid, it's not a sure thing. And in this way, things start to, as I said in the beginning of the talk, this mindfulness and wisdom that develops starts to correct the views, the distorted views in one's mind, and this clarifies the view of reality such that insight arises and frees the mind as a consequence. As a consequence. To trust in this natural development of the path factors is important. I don't know about you, but I can often get caught in a place where I feel like I have to drive this, or I have to create this, or I have to do something different, you know, to get the result. But as soon as I start feeling that, I have to come back and recognize and clarify. Actually, this, if you just put in the application of mindfulness here and now, the rest is going to take care of itself. That's the truth of it. That's what's displayed throughout the suttas and throughout the teachings of the masters. And that enables you to let go. If your only job is to be present, to observe, to be mindful, that enables you to let go of the various things that you come up against as you inquire into them, to not have to push them this way or that, not have to get rid of them or to hold them or to change them, but take confidence in that ability to be present and observe and investigate according to anicca, dukkha, anatta. And these will be the insights that will bring the mind to the end. So I haven't got a clock here, but I do think I've talked for too long. So I'll finish my reflection there. Thank you.